Did everyone receive a handout? If you didn't, we'll, okay.
Thank you, Brother Tim, and good morning. Very happy to be with you this morning. Brother Tim announced the subject, First Great Jubilee. You may recognize that title as the title of one of the chapters of the second volume, which it is. And much of the material we have to mention to you this morning is the same as what is found in Volume 2 in that chapter. If you have considered that chapter, especially if you've considered it recently, this will be in the form of a review. If you have not, or if you have considered that chapter and perhaps you didn't understand it, we trust that this might be of some help to you. As we consider this subject, we would like to consider that the second volume was written in the year 1889. A lot has happened since 1889. We'd like to consider it in the light of what we see happening today. In that chapter, perhaps you'll recall if you've read it, the Brother Russell suggested that the small beginnings of the fulfillment of the Jubilee picture had already begun in his day. Small beginnings of the times of restitution. Now we've gone quite a few years beyond that. We'd like to consider the things Brother Russell observed. Were they just very temporary for the moment, and then they were forgotten about, and really there hadn't been any beginnings of fulfillment at all? Or have those things continued and increased, confirming that these indeed were evidences of small beginnings of a fulfillment? And do we see additional things to those which were occurring in 1889? And then besides this, we'd like to also consider what effect these events that we see happening today might have upon the church in connection with the Jubilee picture. But let's first consider the Jubilee itself as it was observed in Israel. The account of that is found in Exodus 25, and we're going to read a portion of it. Beginning with the first verse of Exodus 25, "And the Lord spake unto Moses in Mount Sinai, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When ye come into the land," now that's an important point right there, "when ye come into the land," this was to happen, "when ye come into the land which I give you, then shall the land keep a Sabbath unto the Lord." This gives the beginning point. "6 years thou shalt sow thy field, and 6 years thou shalt prune thy vineyard, and gather in the fruit thereof. But in the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of rest unto the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. Thou shalt neither sow thy field nor prune thy vineyard." Notice here was a provision for a Sabbath year. Before this time they had Sabbath days. They were to remember every seventh day and not to work, do any work or anything on the seventh day. Remember, one of the Ten Commandments was, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. Now, as the seventh year was to be something special, they weren't to sow anything in their fields. They weren't to reap anything that grew of itself. They were to let the land rest on the seventh year. Now we pass down to the eighth verse. And thou shalt number 7 Sabbaths of years unto thee, 7 times 7 years. And the space of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be unto thee 49 years. Then shalt thou cause the trumpet of Jubilee to sound on the Day of Atonement, on the 10th day of the 7th month, in the Day of Atonement shall ye make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. Notice now, here's something special on the 50th year, after a series of 7 Sabbath years. You notice again the prominence of the number 7. The 50th year was to be something special. And on the Day of Atonement, and this is significant too, on the Day of Atonement, the trumpet should sound, signifying the beginning of the Jubilee year. Let us continue. And ye shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man unto his possession. And ye shall return every man unto his family. A jubilee shalt thou 50th year be unto you. Ye shall not sow, neither reap that which groweth of itself in it, nor gather the grapes in it of thy vine undressed. And then in the 13th verse we read, in the year of this jubilee ye shall return every man unto his possession. And if thou sell aught unto thy neighbor, or buyest aught of thy neighbor's hand, ye shall not oppress one another. According to the number of years after the jubilee thou shalt buy of thy neighbor, and according unto the number of the years of the fruits he shall sell unto thee. According to the multitude of years thou shalt increase the price thereof, and according to the fewness of the years thou shalt diminish the price of it. For according to the number of years of the fruits doth he sell unto thee. Ye shall not oppress one another. If they were to sell a possession, the price was going to be determined until by how many years it was going to be till the next jubilee. Because in that next jubilee year, that possession was going to have to be returned to its original owner. So if you were going to buy a property from a person and the jubilee year was only 5 years away, you're only going to have use of that property for 5 years, and then we have to go back to the person who sold it to you. But if the jubilee was 45 years away, well, you had it for a long time. And maybe the person would even be dead by the time the jubilee year would come. Now we observe in all this that the numbers 7 and 50 are very significant. The 7th day was a Sabbath day. The 7th year was a Sabbath year. The 50th year was a Jubilee year. In addition to that, the 50th day was special too. Beginning in Leviticus 23, we read of this. Leviticus 23:15-16. And ye shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath. This is beginning with the Passover. From the day that ye brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. Even unto the morrow after the 7th Sabbath shall ye number 50 days. And ye shall offer a new meat offering unto the Lord. So the 50th day was to be something special too. The 50th day was known as the Day of Pentecost. Now when we mention the Day of Pentecost, the first thing that comes to our mind, oh, that's the day when the disciples received the Holy Spirit for the first time. And true it is. But that's not what Pentecost means. That's what That's what we as Christians associate with the day of Pentecost. To the Jews, the day of Pentecost was his 50th day after the Passover. After seven Sabbaths were complete, then the 50th day was the day of Pentecost. It was a day of rejoicing and a day of rest. Our subject this morning is the Jubilee. We want to especially consider that 50th year. The 50th year was to be a special year, as we mentioned. No sowing of crops on the land, no reaping of anything that grew on the land, a time when possessions which had been sold were to be returned, a time when servants were to be set free, a time of restoring things back to a former condition. It was a time which was to proclaim liberty to all the inhabitants of the land. It's significant, perhaps you're aware of it already, that on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia is inscribed the scripture, Leviticus 25:10, proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all the inhabitants thereof. The very scripture we just read, proclaiming, announcing the beginning of the Jubilee year. This Jubilee year, we believe, was a picture. It was a type of the times of restitution of all things. And it was a very fitting type, because in that Jubilee year, everything was to be restored. Possessions which were lost were to be restored. People who had lost their freedom were to have it restored to them. And that's what's to happen in the times of restitution. Things which man lost are to be returned to him. He is to be reinstated. And the former rights and privileges which he enjoyed, which Adam enjoyed as a perfect human being, are to be restored to him. But how do we know that this is intended as a type or a picture? We think there we have strong evidence that this is so. The Jubilee arrangement was part of the law which God gave to Israel. We read that in the first verse of Leviticus 25. The Lord spake unto Moses in Mount Sinai concerning this Jubilee. And Moses in turn related to the Israelites. Now we turn to Matthew 5:18, and we find Jesus made reference to this law. And he said concerning this law, for verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Not one jot or one tittle was to pass from the law till all be fulfilled. What's a jot or a tittle? I think they're small marks of punctuation, like accent marks, which the Pharisees used to emphasize certain portions of the word of the law, sometimes emphasizing out of proportion to what it was intended, according to their own traditions. But Jesus said, not the smallest part, these were very small things, not the smallest part is going to pass away from the law without having a fulfillment. Was the Jubilee a small part? Well, stop and consider. Suppose you had a piece of property and you were going to sell it. The price was going to be determined by how long it was until the next Jubilee. Or suppose you were going to buy a piece of property And the price you were going to have to pay was determined by how long it was until the next Jubilee. Would you consider that a small jot or tittle? Or would you consider that something pretty important? Suppose you were a slave, a servant. And in a certain year, the law provided that you were going to be set free. You were going to have your freedom. Would you consider that a small thing? I'm sure you wouldn't. I don't think any of us have ever been in the position of being literal slaves. But we are in bondage to sin, and we look forward to being set free in the fullest sense of the word. We are set free from the standpoint of God's reckoning now. But in the fullest sense of the word, when we're free from all the influences of sin, we still look forward to that, and we don't consider that a small thing. The Jubilee arrangement was not a small thing. It affected every Israelite. It affected everyone, and affected them in a very important way. But Jesus said even the smallest part of the law would not pass away without a fulfillment. But then we look at Israel's history and what happened. At one point of time, they were overthrown. Nebuchadnezzar came and overthrew their king Zedekiah, took them captive into Babylon, and they were there for 70 years. 70 years. What happened to the Jubilee? Could they keep a Jubilee while they were in Babylon for 70 years? Well, how could they? They weren't even in their land to let it rest or to sow or not sow or to reap or not reap. They couldn't restore. Somebody sold a possession to someone else. He couldn't return it to him in the 50th year because he wasn't there himself. He didn't have it himself. A person who had slaves couldn't set them free in the 50th year because now he was a slave himself. He was in captive to Babylon, in Babylon. They couldn't possibly keep a Jubilee. It was tied in with the land. This whole arrangement was to happen when they came into the land. And they were in this condition for 70 years. Somewhere during that 70-year period, there was due to be a Jubilee year, because the Jubilee year was every 50 years. What happened to the Jubilee? Did it pass away? Jesus said, not even the smallest part of the law would pass away without having a fulfillment. We can only conclude that in some way, in some manner, a fulfillment had begun by that time. We'll examine that more closely. We think the Jubilee type, the Jubilee feature of the law, included more than just the Jubilee year. It included the 49-year cycle leading up to that Jubilee year. This was part of the type. This was part of the picture, too. The 49 years leading up to the Jubilee year. Now, to find out when the fulfillment must have begun, it's necessary to find out when the antitype, when the last literal Jubilee was fulfilled or could have been fulfilled. We have to find out how long before that 70 years of captivity, that 70 years of desolation of the land, it was when Israel had their last Jubilee year. Therefore, the type must have ended at that time and the antitype begun in some way. Now, to do this, we have to examine a little bit of Bible chronology and a little bit of Israel's history. In Leviticus 25:2, we read that this was to begin when they would come into the land. This is when the first 49-year cycle was to begin. when you come into the land. Well, let's calculate from Bible chronology how many years it was between entering the land and the time when the land lay desolate for 70 years. This is why we have the chart and the little sheet that we handed out to you at the beginning. It's not in too much detail, but we'll try to explain it as we go along. Sometime during that 70 years, there should have been a Jubilee year, but there was not. Now let's find out at what point was the last Jubilee year. First, we have to find out how many years elapsed from entering the land to the desolation of the land. And then we can divide that by 50, and we find out how many Jubilee years were in that period of time, and that would give us the date, or how many years before the desolation of the land, when the last Jubilee was observed. Well, let's go to Bible chronology. The first point we have is from entering the land to the dividing of the land. Now you notice the Jubilee type was to begin when they entered the land, not when the land was divided among the 12 tribes, but when they would enter the land. And we put down in the chart 6 years between the time they crossed over the Jordan, entered the land, and the land was divided among the 12 tribes. And we'll try to explain how we arrive at 6 years. We turn to Joshua chapter 14, verses 7 and verse 10. Here we find Caleb speaking. Remember, Caleb was one of the 12 spies that Joshua sent out to spy out the land before they entered it and to bring back a report. And Joshua and Caleb, or rather Moses sent these out. Joshua and Caleb brought back a good report saying they should enter the land, but the other 10 said, well, we can't take the land, it's too strong for us. Now, let's see what Joshua is saying at this point. Joshua says, 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. Joshua is telling us he was 40 years old when he was sent out as a spy. And then the 10th verse he says, and now, behold, the Lord hath kept me alive as he said these 45 years, even since the Lord spake this word unto Moses while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness, and now, lo, I am this day 85 years old. Now, if we read the context, we find that Caleb spake this at the time the land was divided among the 12 tribes. So now we find Caleb was 40 years old when he was sent out as a spy. No, Caleb was 40 years old. Caleb is speaking. He was 40 years old when he was sent to spy out the land. And he's 85 years old when the land was divided. That means 45 years elapsed between the sending out of the spies and the dividing of the land. But now, when were the spies sent out? The spies were sent out about 1 year after they left Egypt. So that means 46 years elapsed between the leaving of Egypt and between the leaving of Egypt and the dividing of the land. 46 years elapsed. Now they spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness. So 46 years elapsed between leaving Egypt and the dividing of the land. 40 of those years they spent wandering in the wilderness. So that leaves 6 years between entering the land and the dividing of the land. 46 years from leaving Egypt to dividing of the land, 40 of which were spent in the wilderness, leaving 6 years from entering the land to the dividing of land. So we have our first 6 years. And following the dividing of the land, we have the period of the judges. We turn to Acts 13:20 for this period. Here we have the Apostle Paul speaking. The period of the judges would be very difficult to establish definitely were it not for this statement by the Apostle Paul in the 13th chapter of Acts. And Paul is saying that in Acts 13:20 and after, and he's talking about, the preceding verse shows he's talking about after the dividing of the land. And after he gave them judges about the space of 450 years until Samuel the prophet. Now, King James translation says about 450 years. That leaves some doubt in our minds. That could mean, well, that could mean 451, 452, or maybe even 448. But this word about doesn't really mean about. It has the significance of while or during, and is so translated in many other places in the New Testament. So he gave them judges during the space of 450 years. So we conclude that it was 450 years from the dividing of the land for the period of the judges, which ended in Samuel's time when Israel desired a king. You remember that? And Samuel was a little bit distressed over this because he thought they were rejecting him as a judge over Israel, and the Lord told him, well, they haven't rejected you, they've rejected me. So then we have 450 years from the dividing of the land until Israel wanted a king. Then we have on our chart 513 years for the period of the kings. In Acts 13:21, we find that King Saul's reign, King Saul, remember, was the first king. He was the one that was selected to be king when Israel wanted a king like their neighboring nations, and we read that he was head and shoulders above all the other people of his day. He was very tall and imposing in appearance. And he reigned over Israel for 40 years. And the remainder of the kings, he was succeeded by David. And the remainder of the kings can be traced through 1st and 2nd Chronicles, where they're given in detail. So-and-so reigned so many years, and he was replaced by someone else. And on down through the line of kings to Zedekiah. And Zedekiah was the last one, because Zedekiah was the one whom Nebuchadnezzar overthrew and took captive into Babylon and the rest of the nation with him. And if you add them all together, these are detailed in the second volume in the chapter on Bible chronology, giving all the scripture references which show them, and they total 513 years for the period of the kings. We're not going to go into that detail this morning. You can check that for yourself through the second volume. Now then, we add these together. 6 years, 450 years, and 513 years. We come to a total of 969 years. 969 years from the time they left Egypt and entered the land. From the time they entered the land, crossed over the river Jordan, until Zedekiah and the rest of the nation was taken captive into Babylon and the land lay desolate. 969 years. Now, how many Jubilee years were there in those 969 years? In those 969 years, there would have to be 19 Jubilee years. Because 19 times 50 is 950. So, in a period of 969 years, there would be 19 Jubilee years with 19 years left over. 19 Jubilees would take up 950 years, and 19 of them, 19 years left over until Israel was taken captive into Babylon. So this means that 19 years before the captivity, before the desolation of the land, was a Jubilee year. At that point, we believe that type ended, because there was never again a Jubilee year after that. There couldn't be 50 years from that point. There couldn't be a Jubilee year. They weren't in the land. They had to be in the land to have a Jubilee. So that type must have ended. Jesus said it couldn't end without a fulfillment, beginning. So we believe at that point a fulfillment began. Now how can this be? Surely there was no restitution at that time. Far from it. There was nothing to indicate anything of any significance. We believe at that time began the antitypical cycle, that which the 49-year cycle represented. And nothing of significance happened. Did anything of significance happen the first year after the Jubilee? There were 49 years, then there was a Jubilee year, and then the next year. Was there anything out of the ordinary in that year? No, there was nothing. It was just a plain, ordinary year like the next 48 would be. And so nothing happened following this last Jubilee, 19 years before the desolation of the land. But this was beginning the antitypical cycle. Now, we've learned that in considering types, one general thing to apply is that the antitype is usually larger than the type. And surely this is so. The antitypical Day of Atonement, we believe, represents the Gospel Age. Well, and the type was just one day. The Gospel Age is far more than one day. It's roughly 2,000 years. The antitypical Jubilee was just one year. We think the antitype is far more than just one year. Rather, we think it's 1,000 years. Now, the antitypical cycle, the typical cycle was 49 years, followed by a 50-year Jubilee. We think the antitypical cycle is also much larger than 49 years. But how much larger? How can we figure it? Well, how did we figure the typical cycle? We multiplied 7 times 7, didn't we? Why do we multiply 7 times 7? Because every seventh year was a Sabbath year. And so we multiplied 7 times 7, and the year following that would be a Jubilee year. Now, if we use that same method, every 50 years was a Jubilee year, if we multiply 50 times 50, we come to 2,500. We say 50 times 50 because we include the Jubilee year in that calculation. Not just the 49-year cycle, but we include the Jubilee year just as we included the Sabbath year in multiplying 7 times 7. We didn't multiply 6 times 6. We multiplied 7 times 7. So we multiply 50 times 50 to be consistent. So then, there was to be a 2,500-year cycle before the antitype of the Jubilee year. This 2,500-year cycle was the antitype of the 50-year cycle which led up to the Jubilee year. So now where does that bring us? 2,500 years from this last Jubilee, which was 19 years before the desolation of the land. So that's the next thing we want to calculate. when, what point of time would this bring us to? Well, there were, after this last Jubilee, there were 19 years until the land was desolate. They were taken captive into Babylon. Then the land was desolate. The people were in captivity in Babylon for 70 years. Then, from that point to the year AD 1 was a period of 536 years. And this would be dated from the first year of Cyrus, according to secular history, was the year BC 536. So we'd add 536 years to the 70 and to the 19. And then, how many more years do we need to reach 2500? Well, we need 1875 years, actually. I've listed on the chart, in the second volume, it lists it just that way. I've listed on the chart from AD 1 to the year 1875 would be 1874 years. And if we add these together, 19 before the desolation, 70 years of desolation, 536 to the point of time between the BC and AD, and plus 1874 totals 2499, which would mean the 2500th year would be the antitype of the Jubilee. Brother Russell points out in that second volume calculation that the year 1875, according to the Jewish method of reckoning times and years, would have begun in October of 1874. At that time, we believe the antitype of the Jubilee year was due to begin. The times of restitution. But it wasn't going to be just a year now, as it was in the type. It was going to be 1,000 years. And we stop and consider, there's a lot more involved now in the antitype than there was in Israel in the type. In Israel in the type, it was just one small nation. Just of comparatively few things to straighten out. And yet, stop and consider, 49 years had elapsed since the last Jubilee, 50 years had elapsed since the last Jubilee. During that time, some people had died, some people had moved, some people had sold their property, some people had gotten into financial difficulty and been found it necessary to sell themselves as slaves. And you stop and consider, there's a lot of things to get straightened out. If any of you have ever had a loved one who's died, or a close relative who has died, and you've been named executor or administrator of his estate, you know there's a lot of things to be straightened out. You got to dispose of his property and find out who is entitled to what, and sometimes there's a lot of quarreling over it, and even some hard feelings over it. That's just one individual whose affairs need to be straightened out. Now you have a whole nation whose affairs need to be straightened out, and it took a whole year to do it. But now in the antitype, you don't just have one small nation. You've got the whole world whose affairs need to be straightened out, involving many, many, many more things than in that type. And it takes 1,000 years to do it. It's the same 1,000 years that Peter refers to when he says, one day with the Lord is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. Now we have a further calculation, which we didn't show on the chart. Brother Russell mentions also in the second volume, to show the accuracy of this date. It's based on 2 Chronicles 36, verses 20 and 21, and also Leviticus 26, verses 33 to 35. 2 Chronicles 36 says, "And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia. To fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. For as long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. This tells us that the land was to lay desolate so that then they would keep its Sabbath, because the Israelites didn't do it like they were supposed to do all during this 950 years. Now it was going to really lay to rest and enjoy its Sabbath. Leviticus 26 says, verses 33 to 35, "And I will scatter you among the heathen, and will draw out a sword after you, and your land shall be desolate, and your cities waste. Then shall the land enjoy her Sabbaths as long as it lieth desolate, and ye be in your enemy's land. Even then shall the land rest and enjoy her Sabbaths. As long as it lieth desolate, it shall rest, because it did not rest in your Sabbaths when ye dwelt upon it." Now the most important of these Sabbaths was the Jubilee. Every seventh year was a Sabbath year, but this didn't compare to the Jubilee, the 50th year of Jubilee, in the scope of events. And they were to, the land was to rest for 70 years. Perhaps this is intended to indicate that the Lord intended 70 of these Jubilee years. We saw there were only 19 of them observed imperfectly. The Lord intended 70 of them. And so he had the land rest for 70 years. He removed the Israelites from the land so they couldn't do anything with it. This would mean that there were to be 51 more cycles besides the 19 they had already gone through. Now these 51 more cycles would be only cycles of 49 years, because the land rested the whole 70 at once. They wouldn't include jubilees. When we multiplied 50 times 50, we were including the Jubilee years. Now we're going to multiply 19 times 51. Or, is that correct? 49 times 50. Okay. Yes. I've lost my train of thought. Okay, yes, okay. There were 51 cycles still due. They would only be cycles of 49 years, because they wouldn't include the Jubilee years, because the Jubilee years were all included in the 70. So there would be 49-year cycles, and 51 of them, because 19 of them had already passed. So we multiply 49 times 51, and we come out to something which is 1 year difference from what we show here. We come out to 1 year less than what we have in this calculation. I don't have the figures clearly in my notes here. That's my problem. Oh yes, here it is. 51 times 49 is 2499 instead of 2500. Now, why the 1 year difference? Well, when we figure 2500, that we include the Jubilees in the 50 times 50. So the 2500th year would be a Jubilee year, if we were talking literally. So the 2500th year would be the beginning of the antitype. Now, when we multiplied 49 times 51, we used 49-year cycles, which did not include Jubilees. So it will be the year after the 2499 when the antitypical Jubilee would be, and that accounts for the 1 year difference. But now let us get to what is perhaps the most important part of our discussion this morning. What Brother Russell saw in 1899 as evidences of the fulfillment of this antitypical jubilee. We'd like to read just two paragraphs from Volume 2 on page 197. After pointing out that the jubilee represents the times of restitution, he says, quote, "Let no reader hastily conclude that there are no evidences of restitution about us, nor that the Son of Righteousness is not already gilding the watchtowers of Zion and enlightening the world. Let him, on the contrary, reflect that we are already in the day when the hidden things are being made manifest. And let him remember that the first work of restitution is properly a breaking down of the old and decaying structure which stands in the place which the new is to occupy. Remember that the first work of the tenderest physician is often to open the wounds and to cleanse and amputate according to the necessities of the patient in order to make thorough the work of healing. That such service causes pain and is seldom appreciated by the patient at the time, no one need be told. And so it is with the great work of the great, with the work of the great physician, the restorer, the life giver. He wounds to heal. And the trouble and sifting in the church and the world are but the lancing and cleansing needful and a most important part of the restitution work." We'll just pause here for a moment. I'm sure most of you have been to the dentist on occasions and had a tooth filled. What does the dentist call this? He calls it a restoration. He says he's restoring your tooth. When he fills out the insurance, if you have dental insurance, he fills out the insurance form. This is what he calls it on the form: restoration. Now, when you go to the dentist to have a tooth filled or restored, what does he do? You sit down in the dentist chair, does he just put a filling in that tooth? Well, you know from your own experience that that's not what he does. First, he gets a drill and he starts drilling. And he drills and drills, and after a while, if you happen to put your tongue where the hole was in your tooth, you find that the hole is much larger. It's worse than it was before. This is terrible. Half my tooth is gone. But this is part of the restoration. This is part of what the dentist calls restoration. This is part of what we see taking place today. The Lord is removing some of those things which are in the way for the kingdom. They're in the way for what he wants to accomplish. Just like that decayed portion of the tooth is in the way for the filling. You can't just put a filling over top of that. You're just patching something up and it's not going to last. You have to get rid of that. Just like the dentist has to get rid of that decayed portion of your tooth in order to restore it. Then Brother Russell continues, and we quote again. In the type, the trumpet of Jubilee was to be sounded when the Jubilee year began, to proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof, Leviticus 25:10. And the antitype is ushered in with the sounding of the symbolic seventh trumpet, the trump of God, the last trump. It is indeed the great trumpet. It announces liberty to every captive. And while at first it means the surrender of many expired claims and privileges and a general time of disturbance and unsettling of usages, habits, etc., its full import, when rightly appreciated, is good tidings of great joy which shall be to all people. Notice the Jubilee trumpet was to sound typically on the Day of Atonement. We think this is significant. The antitypical Day of Atonement we understand to be the Gospel Age. That's the age when the atonement sacrifices are being made, the sacrifice of Christ and the church. While that Day of Atonement is still in progress, the antitypical Jubilee trumpet begins to sound, and the events of that antitypical Jubilee begin to take place. The typical Jubilee trumpet did not sound the day after the Day of Atonement, but sounded on the Day of Atonement, while the antitypical Day of Atonement is still in progress. Brother Russell then goes on to mention some of the issues which were then coming to the attention of people in 1889. In fact, he mentions 15 of them. We're going to mention them just briefly and try to take note whether these same issues are before the people today and what, if anything, has happened in the meantime, and also how they might be affecting you and me in our Christian walk. These 15 things he attributes to the beginning of the times of restitution of all things, the antitypical Jubilee. The first one is governmental reforms. Do we hear anything about governmental reforms today? Well, it'd be hard to think of a government on the earth today that's the same now as it was in 1889. Most of the governments have been changed completely. Some have been changed more or less than others. But governmental reforms seems to be a constant issue. The government should do this. The government should not do this. The government should be involved in this. No, it shouldn't. And there's great controversies on this, even to in our day. I think perhaps more so than there was in Brother Russell's day. I can't speak from experience, but well, even today we have the issue of minorities in government. Back in Brother Russell's day, it would be unthinkable to have a black man as a mayor of a major city. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, but you know, in the minds of some people, there still is something wrong with it. But it's a governmental reform. Now we have a woman running for vice president. Many people are very happy and elated over that. Others are distressed over that. But this is an item of governmental reform. It's an issue before the people. It's something that people consider to be their rights, just as black people properly consider that they should have the same equal rights as white people. So women are beginning to say, well, we should have the equal rights of men. Just as in the Jubilee day year, people would say, well, I have a right to this. This really should be returned to me. And another one would say, well, no, it shouldn't go to you, it should go to me. And there would be a dispute over it. The next item, Brother Russell, list number 2 is abolition of standing armies. We don't put it in those words today, but we hear a great deal about disarmament. We hear a great deal today about a nuclear freeze. And there are people who feel very strongly about this, that there should be no more nuclear weapons made or produced, that there's far too many already. And others feel, well, no, you can't do that. You've got to keep up with our potential enemies as a deterrent. And there's a controversy over this. Abolition of standing armies. How do these issues affect the church? Regarding governmental reforms, should we get involved with governmental reforms? Should we try to make the government operate more efficiently? Well, the only thing we could do is perhaps get involved in politics and use our right to vote and so on and try to see what we can do to get a better government. This is not our job. This is not what the church is to do. These are not our rights. We have relinquished those rights when we gave our all to the Lord in consecration. Our citizenship is the new government in heaven, none of these governments on earth. We're not getting involved with the nuclear freeze movement, the peace movement, or the any other movement. We don't know what the Lord's program is for removing these institutions of this present evil world, and we don't want to interfere with what he may have in mind. The third item Brother Russell mentions is a burdensome tax. Is this an issue today? Well, there's a presidential election campaign coming up, and what's the issue that you probably hear more of right now than anything else? Is there going to be a tax increase next year? The Republicans say no, or they reluctantly say no. The Democrats say there's no way it can be avoided, and there's a constant battle over this, the burdensome tax. And everybody's concerned about it because Brother Russell thought there was burdensome tax in 1889. The taxes in 1889, I don't have the figures, but I'm sure they don't compare with the taxes of today. If you ever stop and figure out how much of your income is paid in taxes, you'll be amazed if you include all the hidden taxes as well. But where does the church stand in all this? Jesus said, "Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's." We're not trying to get out of paying taxes. We obey the laws. We want to obey the laws. We want to pay our taxes that are due. We don't like some of the things that's done with the tax money, but it's out of our hands. In fact, you really have no choice in the matter if you're working, because you never even see the money. It's taken out of your pay. But our attitude is that even if it weren't, we would still pay the taxes and be obedient to the laws, because some taxes are necessary. Governments are resorting to other means to raise money. They're in great difficulty, more so than in 1889. Many state governments now are having lotteries to raise money, so they don't have to raise the taxes so much, and they can find another way to get the money. Lotteries, legalized gambling, casinos, horse races, whatever. Means of raising money to avoid taxing the mass of the people. The burdensome tax is very much an issue of our day. The fourth item was the abolition of titled aristocracy. Well, here's an area where we think a great deal of progress has already been made. If we look at the world prior to 1914, which would include 1889, the world was ruled by the titled aristocracy, by kings and princes and nobles, people who were considered to be in a different class. That arrangement has largely passed away. How about the church? Certainly we don't want any titled aristocracy, so to speak, in the church. We don't want anyone with titles which put them in a different class than the rest of the brethren. We don't even want to, in our minds, look up to individuals who might be elders or speakers as being in a different class, an aristocracy, so to speak. We're all brethren. And position. The fifth item, recognizing every man for his manly qualities. This is an item which was probably just beginning in Brother Russell's day, one which had lain dormant for centuries. And what has happened? Well, we've had the whole civil rights movement, as we mentioned before. Not just black people, but all kinds of minorities are beginning to, not only beginning, but have been and continue to demand what they consider to be their rights. Sometimes they are within their real rights, and sometimes they go beyond their rights. But nevertheless, the principle still holds. They want to be recognized as equals of everyone else. Again, this is a reminder for the church that we must remain free from all prejudice of any kind. When we vote for officers in the ecclesia, consider the qualifications of the individual, nothing else. Not what his reputation is, as far as he's well known or something like that, but what are his qualifications? Does he meet the scriptural qualifications as nearly as we are able to meet them in the flesh? Are we free from prejudice? And certainly not what color is he or what nationality is he or anything like that. That should be given no consideration whatsoever. The next item Brother Russell mentions is the abolition of landlordism. And that's still very much in existence, but we observe that it's more regulated today than it was in times past. Landlords are not as free to oppress their tenants as they were in times past, although there is still much wrong and much oppression in that area, even today. The seventh item, we'll have to hurry along. The seventh item is temperance reform. This involves the use of alcoholic beverages, and this is very much an issue today. We hear a great deal about new laws regulating drunk driving. And this is quite a lot of concern to a lot of people. Prohibition was tried after 1889, and it was abolished. It was said that it didn't succeed. This was a little bit before my time. I don't really remember whether it did or not, but the point is the problem is still there. It still exists, and people are recognizing it as a problem. You hear commercials on television and on radio about alcoholics and that they are urged to receive treatment and urged to find ways to control their illness, so to speak. Temperance reform is still very much an issue. Closely related to that is the idea of the use of tobacco and cigarettes. There can be no TV advertising of cigarettes today. This is a reform along that line. There are warnings on packages of cigarettes of the dangers to one's health. And yet, man doesn't know quite how to deal with these problems because money is involved. The love of money is the root of all evil. To abolish these industries, the liquor industry, the tobacco industry, would seriously disrupt the economy. And many people would stand to lose too much money to do that. Where does the church stand in all this? Well, we're not out to reform this present evil world, but as far as our own use of liquor or tobacco, if we have a weakness along this line, let us remember that when we consecrate to the Lord, we said we're going to do what we can to overcome our human weaknesses. And if we have this weakness, we're going to do all in our power to overcome it. And certainly, we'll try to consider others around us and how it might affect them. The eighth item Brother Russell mentions is humane and anti-cruelty societies. These are still in existence and very active in our day, dealing with cruelty to animals, and many people are giving much concern to this. Next item he mentions is societies for the suppression of vice and demoralizing literature. This is a problem which seems to be getting worse instead of better. As the world's moral principles go down, vice and demoralizing literature seems to become more prevalent all the time. In fact, and this too is probably part of the Jubilee antitype, people feel it's their right to have these things and to engage in these things, these immoral practices and this immoral literature. People feel that, well, I have a right to read what I want to read, to see what I want to see, to watch in the movies what I want to watch. They feel this is their right. Just as in the real Jubilee, people demanded what they thought were their rights sometimes when they weren't really rights at all. Again, the church is involved. As the world's morals decline, we must be careful that our morals do not decline along with them. The tenth item he mentions is anti-adulteration societies. This matter is constantly coming into greater prominence. Legislation concerning the labeling of containers of food are becoming more and more strict, more and more demanding, so that people can know what's in the food that they're consuming and avoid anything they might feel is harmful. We feel there's a warning for the church here too. We shouldn't be over concerned about our own health and our own food. We can become so taken up with reading up on what's good for us and what's harmful to us and health food and all that, that we had no time to be concerned about the truth. We want to take care of our bodies in a reasonable way, but we don't want to become overly concerned with that so that we spend all our time concerning matters of physical health. The 11th item is laws to protect lives and health. Today we have laws governing the treatment of sewage, laws governing the purification of drinking water, laws governing poisonous and flammable materials. We have building codes, plumbing codes, wiring codes. We have traffic laws. We have all kinds of laws dealing with the safety and health of the individual. As members of the church, we want to obey these laws. These are good laws. This includes traffic laws, speeding laws. The 12th item, we'll have to hurry along, is pure air for minors. Today we don't just say pure air for minors, we just say pure air for everyone. Air pollution is one of the major problems of today. And this is an issue of far greater prominence than in Brother Russell's day. People are aware of this, and they're demanding pure air to breathe, whether it's outside, in the home, or in the workplace, or wherever. The 13th item, laws regulating the treatment of working people. There's a place up in near Elverson, Pennsylvania. It's called Hopewell Village. If you ever get a chance, it's a good place to visit. It's a national park, and it's free. And they give you a little description of what the place is all about. It was a little village operated in the early 1800s where people lived there and they worked there. There was iron ore mined in the area. It was melted. The trees were chopped down in the area to produce charcoal, to fuel the furnaces, to produce the iron. They made stoves. The people who lived and worked there, that's all they did. They lived and worked there. They never left the place. They worked the long hours there. They got very little pay. They bought their food from the company store, company-owned store, and of course the profits for that went back to the company. They lived in little company-owned houses, and sometimes they got paid not in money but in food. lived with the barest necessities. Could such an operation exist today? We'd say, no way. In a very short time, they'd have a union. And that would all change. Today, men have to be paid in cash and paid well. They can't live like that. They're not willing to live like that. It's part of the antitypical jubilee, their rights. The laws regulating the treatment of working people. Today, they must have Social Security, Medicare, paid vacations, paid holidays, overtime pay, all kinds of fringe benefits, which were non-existent at that time. 14th item, fire escapes and capacities of rooms. Just recently we heard of a serious fire in an amusement park in New Jersey, and now there's all kinds of investigations of amusement parks and the safety of the rides and the buildings and so on, especially regarding fire. It's still an issue in our day. And the last item he mentions is the liability of railroads and steamship lines for the safety of passengers. And today we would add airlines. But now, you can imagine someone might saying, well, these are changes that are taking place. But haven't there always been changes all along, all down through the gospel age and even before? Haven't there been changes all the time? Well, yes, there have been changes. But I don't know how many of you have read the latest issue of the Bible Students newsletter. There's a very interesting item in that latest issue, which is called Change Changed. Change Changed. We'd like to read a portion of it to you in case you haven't read it. It says, most of the problems facing human society today can be said to have been brought about by the change revolution. And then it proceeds to mention a book that it recommends very highly. And it says, in this book, the author uses an illustration of a clock. And in this book, the author says, let the clock stand for the time men have had access to writing systems. And the time men have been able to write. It says, our clock would thus represent something like 3,000 years, and each minute on our clock, 50 years. Just imagine the face of a clock, and each minute would represent 50 years. On this scale, there were no significant media changes until about 9 minutes ago. At that time, the printing press came into use in Western culture. About 3 minutes ago, the telegraph, photograph, and locomotive arrived. 2 minutes ago, the telephone, rotary press, motion pictures, automobile, airplane, and radio. 1 minute ago, the talking picture, television, has appeared in the last 10 seconds. The computer came in the last 5 seconds, and communication satellites in the last second. The laser beam, perhaps the most potent medium of communication of all, appeared only a fraction of a second ago. Then it mentions other areas. It says, in medicine, you would have had almost no significant changes until about 1 minute ago. In fact, until 1 minute ago, as Jerome Frank has said, almost the whole history of medicine is the history of the placebo effect. About a minute ago, antibiotics arrived. 10 seconds ago, open-heart surgery. In fact, within the past 10 seconds, there probably have been more important changes in medicine than is represented in all the rest of time on that entire clock. Says, in other words, change isn't new. What is new is the degree of change. The degree of change. About 3 minutes ago, there developed a qualitative difference in the character of change. Change changed. And says, this is really quite a new problem. For example, up until the last generation, it was possible to be born, grow up, and spend a life without moving more than 50 miles from home, without ever confronting serious questions about one's basic values, beliefs, and patterns of behavior. Indeed, without ever confronting serious challenges to anything anyone knew. Stability and consequent predictability within natural cycles was the characteristic mode. But now, in just the last minute, we've reached the stage where change occurs so rapidly that each of us in the course of our lives has continuously to work out a set of values, beliefs, and patterns of behavior that are viable or seem viable to each of us personally. And just when we have identified a workable system, it turns out to change. It's the degree of change. We're living in a time of change, such as never was before. This is the jubilee, the antitypical jubilee. True, we don't see mankind being restored to perfection yet. We don't see the dead coming back. But let us remember that the Apostle Paul said that he must reign till he has put all enemies under his feet, and the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. We trust that these remarks might be helpful and encouragement to you concerning the times we're living in, and I apologize for running over time. I no doubt spent too much time on the early part of the talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Bill, for that very interesting and enlightening discourse. Part of your running over time was because I didn't come up and stop you also. But some of the interesting comparisons between the turn of the century and today, what we see happening and how the events have expanded and gotten broader. We see those same things happening today. It's a beautiful picture to us for the times of restitution and seeing these things come about and knowing that what was seen in 1899 is on such a broader and grander scale today. Beautiful picture for us, and of course the ultimate conclusion of the thoughts brought out about the times of restitution, the millennial kingdom, and the part that the church will have to play in that as well.
We'll ask Brother Bill to close his discourse and ask for the Lord's blessing upon our testimony meeting. We'll have a short testimony meeting before we dismiss for lunch. Brother Bill.
Our dear loving Heavenly Father, hallowed be thy name. We humbly and reverently come to thee and thank thee for thy many plans and purposes, for the promises that are contained in thy word, and for the hopes of the kingdom that are just before us. We thank thee for the measure of understanding thou hast given us. And now we ask that thou be with us, continuing our testimonies to one another, and our further efforts to praise and serve thee. We ask thee also to rule from the beginning.